I want to make sure if there's anyone out there that doesn't have decent headphones, because you know, the things we're doing this week require that you listen to each track fairly carefully and make some changes in it. And so your judgment via the frequency balance is important. So if you're still using earbuds or something and trying to make do with that, I'd be happy to loan you a pair. If you're in the Spokane area, I can put some on the porch. I have some Sennheisers that aren't too expensive, but are pretty good. And you're welcome to borrow them and just include them in the kits and bring them back when you're done. It may make your job easier. So I want to make sure you know that if you're listening with some sort of an earbud, it's really hard to judge bass, whether it's too loud or too quiet, because either they don't have any bass at all particularly, or they make all kinds of bass sound good. They're not the best thing. So I've got some. If you'd like, give me a text or let me know, and I'll put some on the porch and you can borrow them and keep them until the end of the quarter. This week is what I think editing's all about. Whether you're doing something like the assignments I've given you, where there are a couple of simple music mixes, I like that because it's pretty straightforward and there aren't too many instruments that you have to deal with at once. What we do, whether you're working in film or you're working with any kind of a production, is you're mixing tracks. And so that's what we're getting to today. And the things that I ask you to do, for instance, equalization on individual tracks, I want you to really understand that EQ, for instance, is what makes it good. If you don't do that, then it isn't really too much of a mix. I mean, anybody can put tracks in and have them come together in an output and maybe pan a little bit right and left. But the mixing is where it starts to become a skill when you do equalization. Pay attention to that demonstration I did. And what we're up against when we're doing a mix is that every track has the potential of masking other tracks. Every track can mask something else. And so you kind of go through and look for areas where they might be sharing a lot of frequency information and maybe give them a little bit of a diet, take a little bit out. I think that in most cases in a mix, there's always frequencies in that area of boxy or muddiness that we talked about between 200 and 400, for instance. That's kind of where it all builds up. And if you have an instrument, if you remember the rhythm guitar in that first song, if you haven't tried it yet, you'll hear it. It's just a strumming archtop guitar. And it has a nice full range. When you hear it by itself, it sounds nice. It sounds nice and warm and full. If you notice in my demonstration, I pulled down the lower frequencies quite a bit. I actually did enough that where you look at it, you'll think, really that much? But when you listen to it, it still sounds smooth and full. And when you hear it in the mix, your brain will tell you that all of those low frequencies are there. And so you don't need them in there. And what happens if you leave them in is that there's a lot of tracks have energy in areas they don't need. And all that energy sort of builds up and becomes what I would call mud. And then it starts to really mask other things. So don't be afraid to try EQ in general, doing a high pass, rolling off some of the lows on most tracks, voices and acoustic guitars and so on. You won't lose anything important. And so what I generally do is I will try pulling those down until I think, okay, now I know I've got too much taken out of it. And then I bring a little bit back in and then I try it in the mix. So don't be afraid to try that. In the future, you'll get a set of tracks and there might be two vocal tracks in there and they are somebody singing the same thing, or two bass or two guitars. And so my point is that you don't have to use every track that's given you. They may be there because the person did what we call two takes. And so it's expected that you might pick the best, either the best one or maybe the best parts. You only need one in those cases. If it's a harmony or if it's something that comes in at a different time than the melody, then it's there for another reason. It's counterpoint or something like that. But if it's exactly the same thing sung again by the same person, aha, you don't need both of them. That's there for you to pick and choose. We will have a quiz next week, not this week, but next week. And it will be on modules 5 and 6. I am getting a few calls on my phone. And they're being muted and noted as scams. If you're calling me and I'm not answering, text me first. If you do a text, it always shows up and then I'll call you back or I'll get your number in. But I look at those and I see 5 scams in a half an hour reported and I'm thinking, maybe somebody's trying to get in and my carrier isn't letting him. So keep trying. So let's get started. I'm starting with questions. What is meant by non-destructive editing? Generally, this software is a little different than what we've used up until now. If you change EQ or you put reverb on something in Audacity and you save it and close it, the reverb is there. It's sort of stained into the audio, if you will. So it becomes a part of the file. In the software that we're using now, Studio One, everything that you do can be undone anytime you want. So Studio One does not save your effect as it's applied, but what it saves is the process that you put the effect on, and it redoes it the next time you open it. So it goes back and applies that effect so you can hear it the next time. And that means that the original files are always there and they're never touched. So they're all still there. And if you do something that's a real problem, you didn't screw it up, you can always back up and get those tracks again. But that's non-destructive editing. You don't actually change the original files by doing this editing. Okay, in Studio One, what types of files are found in the browser? That's over on the right-hand side. And they have a little bit of everything you might want to use. There are files in there. There's a way to get into your hard drive and find any files that might be on your hard drive anywhere. There are loops there, so there's loop cat or loop sets that hopefully you downloaded when you download Studio One, and they'll all show up there. And so you don't need your own loops this week, but you will in a couple of weeks from now. So having your own will be a useful thing. So hopefully you have loops, instruments, and so instruments are software that play, that sound like an instrument and will play for you. So those instruments are included there, whether it's a piano or it's an organ or it's a bass or a drum set, those instruments are there. And then there are effects show up there, and the effects are things like reverb and, you know, an EQ and all of that stuff that we use. I call them plugins a lot, but they're also called effects. And there's also in the browser, there's cloud access. So you can get to things that are stored on the cloud, download things that are available to you that way. So it's a way that you can get to everything that you might want to get inside of Studio One. In mixing, what track level should you start with? Generally, if you've got, you know, 5 tracks or 20 tracks, you put them all at -6 decibels and start there. So if you leave everything at 0, and as they come in, you'll notice that your faders might be at 0. They all sound fine individually, but when they are mixed together for your output, they add up. The sound does that. And so you'll get clipping in a hurry. So you start everything at about -6. That's a good average level. And then the things you need to bring up, you bring up from -6 to -3, for instance. And things that don't need to be as loud, you move them down from -6 to -12 or -20. But if you start a -6, then you won't later on in the process say, oh, everything's too loud. Now I got to go back and take everything down. And I don't know whether my mix is going to be the same anymore because of all the other things going on here. So -6. Which range of frequencies usually build up problematically? You know, the ones that I call boxy or muddy in previous discussions. And that's in that range, probably it's lows, probably in the, you know, 200 to 400 range in there. And maybe a little lower than that, it depends, but somewhere in there, there's usually too much, or there's usually more than enough information in any track. If you're doing a solo interview and it's one voice at a time, that's not a problem. But if you've got 4 or 5 things going at once, you'll find that you don't need those frequencies to be as strong in order to have it, to have the effect, the perception be that they're there. And if you take them out, the whole mix becomes a lot clearer, and you can then focus on the things that you want people to hear. There's always a track or two that you really want them to hear. It might be the main vocal part, or in a film, it might be, you know, the ticking of the clock. That's an important thing for them to hear right there, and something happening in the background. But if you sort of carve away frequencies out of the tracks that are playing, then you can hear the ones that are left. And because of the way that our brain hears these things, those things now become prominent and they're sort of featured because there's room in the frequency range for them, so that you kind of carve a little bit of frequency out of all the tracks where it's not needed in order to make room for a track that needs to have those frequencies show up. So what does audio compression do? What compression does is it changes the difference in levels between the part of a track that's loud and the part of the track that's quiet. So we're talking about one track here generally, or at least I am right now. So it might be the guitar track in that Lullaby of Birdland, for instance. And there are times when it's a little louder and there are times when it's a little quieter. If you compress, what you're compressing is the range. So if you say, oh, louder's here, quieter's here, and I can kind of see it in the waveform. And if I compress that, that means there'll be less difference. So the parts that are loud will not be that much more louder than the parts that are quiet. And another way of saying that is the parts that are quiet will be brought up, and the parts that are louder might be pushed down a little bit. But that range from loud to quiet is compressed, and now there's not that much difference. And so it actually sounds great on most things. And so pop music uses it on everything, and they use it a lot. And there are times when they overuse it, and it means that every instrument, you can always hear it all the time. It gets a little busy and it gets a little muddy, but compression is a wonderful tool. So my example was in that Lullaby of Birdland, if you recall, is the guitar. Sometimes you'd hear it and sometimes you wouldn't hear it, because it would, you know, if you didn't, you could either make it all loud and then you hear it all the time, but it gets in the way of the other instruments. So you don't want to do that either. So you want to have it as a background instrument, but you want to always hear it. So we compress it. And that, and so when we could compress it, we can make the difference between the loudest and the quietest strums be very close. And so now when you change its level, you can hear it all the time, and it's not loud, but it's always there. So it's present. So, and that's what we do with compression. We also use compression a lot on the main bus output, the mixing bus output. And if you experiment with that, you'll find that once you do a mix like Lullaby Birdland or even Aloha, in your bus, you can add, your only choice here is to use that same tool, the channel strip, because that's the only free compressor that Studio One gives you, but it works fine. And so you can compress a couple of tracks that need it in the mix. And then once the mix is done over in the main mix, you can put a compressor in there. And this is really done almost all the time. And it'll make all the music a little bit more even in level. And if you don't overdo it, it sounds great. That was originally done, and you can imagine this, because everybody was listening to radio. They didn't have tape decks or any kind of audio systems in the cars, and radio stations wanted a way to make sure that when you're driving in a car, and see, this is when I was very young and you were just thinking about getting bored, but with the window noise and everything, you couldn't hear the music when it got quiet. So they invented these things called compressors, and that meant that the music never got quiet. So they could put a compressor on their transmitter, and when you're driving around, you hear the whole range all the time, because they compressed it, so there wasn't much change in levels. There wasn't much dynamics, and then they cranked the whole thing up so that you could hear your car radio. And those same devices that we used back then, which were in the 50s, the late 50s and so on, and I have a couple of new versions of them over here on the side, they're still used in every pop recording that's made, because they just sound great. They're a compressor, and so they're still used. And now we just use them because it's like candy, and it makes it all into hot chocolate or something like that. I don't know what the metaphor would be, but you try a little bit of it on the bus too. In Lullaby Birdland, how did the sound of the rhythm guitar change after applying compression? Well, my answer would be it's not too loud, but it's always steady and it's present. You can hear it all the time, even though it's not loud. In an equalizer, what does changing the Q do? Well, it's the range that you're boosting or cutting. So in an equalizer, like the one you're given in Studio One, you don't have a lot of choice over Q. I think they got two buttons. They have a wide Q or a narrow Q. But so you can have a Q that boosts a lot of frequencies, or you can have a Q that uses a narrow one. So if you were trying to get a hum out of it or a buzz, and you wanted to do the EQ for that, you would use a larger Q number, and the larger Q number gives you a narrower cut. I guess I ought to do it that way. And so that's what Q is about. It's how wide your booster cut is. In a musical mix, which tracks are usually put in the center of the pan? And right, because you do use pan, move things right and left. And I would encourage you to use pan ambitiously on this assignment. You know, don't have everything crowded in the middle. Spread them out a little bit. And see if you like it. But so first of all, if you're doing a mix that's going to be shown in a theater, in a movie theater, then anything that needs to be heard by everybody in every seat probably has to come out of the middle, right? Because if you put it in the right or left-hand side, like dialogue, it might be heard by the people on the right side of the theater and not on the left. So anything that needs to be heard by everybody in the room, you put in the middle. In dance music, it's usually the bass and the backbeat, you know, whatever those drums are and stuff. They're right in the middle, because then it comes out of both speakers, and that's the kind of the most important thing, or is that beat and that bass that's so inspiring. So those things are in the middle. If you're doing a jazz recording, you know, what is in the middle is probably the vocalist, or if there's a solo instrument, we usually put that in the middle. By the way, if you're talking about compression, and you're recording classical music or jazz, for instance, you don't do that busk compression unless the producer asks you to, because it's generally not done. And those styles where you're recording some classical or jazz musicians, we want all the dynamic range in, and people will have good systems in their home to listen to it, so they can hear that full dynamic range. So we do not compress generally classical or jazz music. All right. When you start mixing, how do you know if you are creating a proper mix? Well, that's one of the tricks, isn't it? You wait and see what grade that I give you. Forgive me, I could. That's not only dumb, but it isn't true. But you know, generally, what you do is you try to find a model to use. So something that is considered a good recording, a commercial recording of something that's in that genre, and you listen to that, and then you listen to yours, and you listen to that again, and you think, what's different about what I do and what's there? And you always do this. The people that go around making their livings as, mastering engineers will always, if they have to travel, they travel with recordings that they know are well recorded or that they've done. And whatever new system they get on, the first thing they do is they put that in, and they might spend a half an hour listening to things, getting their brain tuned in. And that's what through this system in this room, that's a good sound. And then they'll go back and start doing their mix, because every room they go into might sound a little different. Every speakers are a little different. So compare it to something that is considered a good mix. I think that's the best thing. If you ever have a client who asks you to do a mix and you're not sure about the, you know, that genre, the first thing you do is say, can you give me some examples of things that you really like, that you think are done very well? I want to hear those first, and then spend some time with them, and maybe make a few notes, and then you'll do a better job for them, because you have to, you're doing what they want rather than making it up. Why should you listen to a mix on more than one speaker system? This assumes that you don't have a calibrated system. So I have to say that first. If you are doing it in a room where the system has been tuned, where a lot of efforts are made to have that system work in a room for a listening position and sound really well balanced, then you have no idea what those speakers are doing to your music. So, you know, every commercial speaker, every home speaker, just about every one of them that we can afford, they boost certain frequencies like microphones do, and they cut certain other frequencies, and they favor certain things. And so if you're listening to it and judging your mix on those speakers, maybe they have a little more bass. And so when you judge, you'll think, oh, I got a little too much bass in this mix, right? So you turn the bass down a tiny bit, and you go, boy, now that sounds well balanced. And then you take it somewhere else with speakers that don't have that bass boost, and it doesn't sound right. Once you think I'm done, it's always good to, you know, go somewhere else, go in your car, or go and, you know, with some other headphones, or go to some other room and try it on some other system, whatever it is. And if you're getting a good mix, it should sound reasonably good on anything you play it on. It might not have the bass anymore because it's a little Bluetooth speaker or something like that, but you know that. But anything you mix should still sound good on that. So once you think you're done, listen to it on a couple things just to make sure. How does mixing become an important part of communication design? Well, in anything that you create, especially if you're working in the communication industry, like advertisements and you know, and those kind of things, then you have to find out or decide what's the most important communication part here? What is it that needs to be communicated in order to make this a successful project? And so it might be the voice, or it might be the energy, or it might be the the power of it, or it might be the rhythm of the percussive instruments or something. Well, whatever's most important to it, then you have to make sure that you keep that as a sort of a focus of the mix, and don't make something else interfere with it. So you probably, in my class at least, you have some, and in many cases, if you're trusted, you have some say over what to bring up or bring back in the mix. But generally, what's the most important part of this assembly for communication? All right. Is it the message, the voice, the sentiment, the pulse, all of those things? You will be considering how tall, deep, and wide a mix is. Those are just my little buzzwords to help you remember that you have all these things to work with. A tall is a way and I borrowed that from another person, but it means everything from bass to treble. Use the whole thing. And so if you've got a lot of things that you're hearing at once, and you hear a lot of bass, but you're not hearing much treble, well, maybe there are some details in there that you need to bring up with EQ, or maybe there's some bass details in there you need to bring down with EQ. But when you end up, You would probably want to have something in all the ranges and all the octaves. You don't necessarily have to, but consider that. And if it isn't there, then maybe you're missing an opportunity to make it a little better. So that's tall. Deep is just from the viewpoint of the listener. Does it seem to be close or farther away? And so, we did part of that when we did that little walking tour through all those rooms. And if you have a room where the walls are further away, we made them appear that way by adding more reverb, a longer reverb, a longer pre-delay before you heard the reverb. It sort of mimics the way the sound would go out and come back and tell us that we're, even if our eyes are closed, that we're in a large room. So we did the same thing in mixes. And so if you have, maybe you want to sort of think of the mix as a stage, and that's a common one. And so you have the, certain performers that are closer. Maybe you've got a sax and a trombone or something up there doing some jazz, and they're a little closer to the audience. They wouldn't have as much reverb. They wouldn't, in the real auditorium, they wouldn't. That you'd hear them a little bit more of the dry. So that's how you mix it. And if you're going to have some congas or something playing, and they are in the back of the stage, you'd put more reverberant effects on them. So we do that in a mix. So things that we can actually have like three levels pretty easily in a mix. Those items that are close, those that are a little further away, and those that are furthest away. And so it's how much reverb, how much reflections that we're adding to the sound. There's another question in here somewhere that is, it's coming up. If you want to make a particular track seem very close to the listener, if you think about somebody whispering to you, coming up very close and whispering, the way your ears work is you will hear lows and highs a little better if they get closer. Especially the highs, especially the sibilants, you hear more of that. And so if you wanted to sound like they're closer, then you boost the highs a bit, sort of smoothly. It wouldn't be all the highs above 1K, but you'd maybe have a little curve that would bring those up and a little bit more, and maybe boost a little of the lows too. So you have a little bit more low, especially if it's in a voice, because if they get close, you hear the resonance of the voice more easily than you would if it's in a room. So a little bit highs and lows, and you don't put effects on it, or hardly any. If it's somebody's whispering in the movie viewer's ear, you won't hear much of that bouncing off the walls, unless they're, it's a scene in a culvert or something, maybe they would be. But if you were in a normal room, you get closer to the ears. It's like getting closer to the mic. It doesn't pick up the room as much. So that's what we're there. Okay. Let's see. Wide is just panning right to left. And that's the easiest way in the world to keep things from masking each other, is to pan them somewhere a little differently. And so experiment with that. It may sound better. Okay. Which one was the reverb panning? There we go. All right. What are seven categories of adjustments you'll make in a mix? Well, timing is one. So, you know, you can actually, by sliding the track, you can actually control when it happens. So the tracks I give you for these mixes, this week especially, and some of the musical ones, you have to do the opposite. You have to, I mean, kind of, is make sure that when you slide them all into to Studio One or whatever you're mixing them with, they all line up exactly right to start with, because that's the way they were recorded. So if you slide them in and you zoom in and make sure they all started exactly the same millisecond, then those instruments will play together. And so the timing will be correct. If you bring them in and there's a little change in that, then you're going to delay an instrument. And it's like there's somebody who hasn't gotten or isn't seeing the conductor. And so they're playing behind the beat. It sounds awful. Anyway, so be sure when you start, you have them all lined up. You may in these kinds of mixes, you may after that go in and eliminate some quiet areas before the instruments start to play, because you might hear some noises in there. You might hear some ticks, or you may have somebody in the background tapping their foot or something. And so you want to cut that out because you don't need it. But don't do any of that cutting until you get them lined up perfectly, because after you cut, then who knows where the front of it is, you know? It's just that would be where you cut it. So line them up first, and then if you want to go in and trim the front, do that second. So timing, balance, of course, is in relative levels with those faders. Which one is louder, which is quieter? Don't have them be all exactly the same, please. I'm going to look at it and I'm going to assume in these two mixes that there are some things that don't need to be as loud as something else. So that's balance. And then the frequency range. And most tracks can use a little equalization. And I've asked you in the assignment to turn in a couple of screenshots. And what I'm hoping to see in your screenshots are some of your effects that you've used. If you do a screenshot of Studio One with that mix or console window showing, it shows all your tracks with little sliders on them. And above them, it shows little tiny boxes with your channel strip, for instance, is in there. So there, you know what you're using. And it also shows me the curve on top of it. So I can glance at that, and I'll listen to what you send. And I'll think, if I don't know, I want to see that little curve to see what you did to it. And so it's important that I see, you know, that's what I'm after here is to see those controls. And it also shows me if you've got the pan right or left on each one. And so I'm expecting width and depth and tall and short. Let's see, where am I at here? There was one. Oh, okay. So there's panning. There's the dimension. This time, front to back, you can do it all with your just fine doing it all with the same reverb. And if you wanted to, if you had a little extra time and you wanted to put a little heavier reverb on something to move it in the background, go right ahead. The only way I've shown you to do that would be to take the reverb plug in and put it on that one track. If it's like a drum track, you put it on that track and turn the reverb up on it. That's a fine way to do it. It'll sound right. Later on, we'll look at ways that we can use one reverb and just change how much we send to it from each of the instruments, which ends up being a lot more efficient use of your computer's power. But if you know, this time I'm going to be just looking for sort of an overall reverb, and that's enough. Later on, I'm going to expect to see a little difference front to back. Dynamics. I hope that you use dynamics somewhere here. You might use it just as I did on the rhythm guitar. There might be another, that woman's voice could use a little compression. It will sound better if you do. So it'd be cool if you try that. And a little bit overall on the master mix when it's there. You'll like what you hear. You don't have to use a lot of it. And probably it's better if you don't use a lot of it, but try it out. And the final thing for adjustments is interest. And that would be the case if you're given tracks and you've got more than enough, like, guitar tracks, say, for instance, the rhythm guitar tracks, they're going, maybe there's three of them in there. And you might be able to say, okay, I'm going to be the producer and make these decisions now, not just a mixer, but a producer. We don't need them all going all the time. It is boring. They mask each other. It isn't interesting. So I'm going to use this one and the first one verse, this one in the second verse, and then I'll bring both of them in on the third verse, and it'll make the energy a little higher. But that's interest. So you decide what makes it interesting as you go through. There are no hardly any successful pop music mixes ever where the same instrumentation is all the way through. Okay, what five options do you have at your disposal if two instruments or two effects or any two tracks seem to mask each other? So if they have frequencies that are hiding each other a bit, okay? So you can turn one up and one down. So that's level, that works. You can favor different frequencies. So you can have one that has a little boost at say 1,000 cycles, but it has a little cut at 500 cycles. And then the other one, you could do the opposite. You could boost it a little at 500 cycles and cut it at 1,000. Now you have two of them that sound more different. And so they won't mask each other as much. You can also pan them apart. You know, don't have them close to each other. You can also alternate them and not have them both play at the same time. And of course, you're in the studio and you have control over this. You can re-record part of it. You can say, well, we're going to change it. We're going to put something else in there, use a different guitar, play something different, use a different amp, something to make it sound different. But that would be another way to deal with it. Why is EQ an important consideration for every track in the mix? And the main reason is not because the sounds aren't pretty good when you record them. They might be. But there's always a likelihood of unnecessary frequency buildup, especially, you know, in that boxy mud range, especially around 150, 200 to 400 range. There's always extra energy there that you don't need. And some mixes, after you work on it for a long time, you think, boy, it's still too darn busy and muddy down there. And the voices aren't really kind of clear and easy to hear. And what it is the reverb from all those other channels is down there, and it has that muddiness. So you go to the reverb, put an EQ on that, and then you take out that low end of the reverb, and then all of a sudden, oh, now it's clear because there's a lot of energy down there. So where do you usually start from when building a classical or jazz recording mix? Well, most of those mixes start by decisions in the concert hall or the studio where you're recording them, because they're usually recorded live, and you're not doing multi-channels. You're not adding channels afterwards. That's more rare. I don't know if it's ever done in classical recording. I've never heard of it, but of course there's millions, so there might be one or two. But you start with a pair of microphones in the studio or in the concert hall that are set up to pick up a nice stereo range. This is a little beyond what we do in this class, but there's a number of ways of doing that where you can have a pair of them over the conductor, for instance, that pick up stereo. And so you start with that. And so the answer here is you start with a nice stereo mix using microphones that were set up to capture stereo. And then you add to it with what we call spot microphones or accent microphones that you might have around the ensemble that maybe pick up the soloist a little better, and so on. So, but generally start in the middle with a stereo microphone mix. So that's the answer. And if you want to do that, that's one of the things that I sort of concentrate on design 385. If I'm ever teaching it, we march over to the recital hall with a bunch of equipment and try this stuff out and record things over there. Okay. Let's see. Where do you usually start from when building a horn or string section mix? Well, generally that's just a rule of thumb. You start with the higher pitched instruments. If you're going to have a section, you start by bringing in the high pitched instruments. And so, you know, it might be soprano and then tenor and then so on. And you work down the bass. So start with the high pitched instruments and bring the other ones in. That's just in general. Here's a repeat question. When you start mixing, where do you set track levels? Minus 6 decibels. What is meant by dynamic range? I think I covered that really well. So let's just skip ahead. what are the general characteristics of these mixing styles? So I could give you a little slide there that and talked about it a bit that had urban, commercial, Nashville, and jazz classical. And so just kind of the ways we treat that, urban mixes have a lot of samples, and you haven't used samples yet, but they are pre-recorded bits of sound. If you go into my sound library, you'll find a whole bunch of in there that are from the 808 rhythm machine. I think it's Korg 808 or something, and they're classic boom-ch, boom-ch sounds that have been used. That little machine was supposed to be sort of an automatic doing rhythms, and people love the little sounds. They're kind of cheesy little sounds, but the people just loved them. And so now you find it's hard to find any year recently where popular music doesn't have a couple big hits where that's what's used for the accents. They bring back those things, and they were like early 80s, and they bring those back, and they have those spoomp sounds in there. They're just they're like ear candy, but they're sampled. And so that you find a lot in urban mixes, those sounds, very familiar sounds, and they didn't need to pay a percussionist. I'm sorry if there's a percussionist here in this class. I'm sorry, but you and I, being a bass player, are losing gigs because of sampling. Okay. Also, urban sounds has a lot of compression, a lot of layers, a very wide EQ. In other words, they really use the low and the high ranges. So especially the low ranges and urban sounds, they have a lot of energy down there in between like 30 and 60 cycles, and you hear it on a lot of music. It's very strong. So they have that strong low frequency range, and they use a lot of samples, a lot of compression, and lots of layers of sound to build it up. That's urban. Commercial music, what I'm talking about there is music that goes into commercials, if you will. Those have a lot of compression, because they don't want you to sleep through them, right? If you're on the couch and you fell asleep and now a commercial starts up, what? It sounds louder? Is it louder? Well, it's only louder because they never let it get quiet. And so they compress it. And so it's highly compressed. And the other thing they have on those is a little limited bandwidth. So the frequency range is not wide, because people might be watching it on their iPads or their phones. Even if they have a TV, if they don't have a sound bar under it, then they're not going to hear below 60 cycles anyway, or maybe below 100 cycles. So you don't want to have important information down there. So you design it so that all that you can hear everything if you hear between 100 and maybe 8,000 cycles. It's all in there, everything that you need for a commercial mix. All right, Nashville. Now, Nashville uses EQ and compression and all that stuff, and it uses samples too, but they try very hard not to use as much of it as everybody else uses. They try to make the impression that it's all naturally occurring instruments, and they use a lot of acoustic instruments in there. They never use the Korg 808, I don't think, for their percussive sounds. But they do, and even in Nashville, they will start out with a software instrument to play bass, or some drums sometimes. So unfortunately, I hate that, but they do some of that. But Nashville generally doesn't have as many layers. It has less compression. They use less samples, and they make it sound like actual instruments if they can. So it sounds more natural. You know, you might also say that they leave sort of room around the instruments so you can hear each one. Rather than have a layer built up of sounds that creates a new sound, they'll have each instrument have its own voice in the mix and stays there. And finally, jazz classical. I would say very little compression, very wide dynamic range, which is, I guess, another way of saying very little compression, isn't it? A wide dynamic range. Natural reverberation. I have a fellow who might be coming over tomorrow to do some classical guitar recordings, and we put a little bit of reverberation on his, because I can't recreate a good room here. So we picked a lot of reverberance spaces, and he found one that he liked. He said, wait, I like that one. And it's a particular church in Italy. So I have these, these type of reverb where I can bring in an image, you might say, of the acoustics of that church. And he says, yeah, I've heard a concert in that church. That's what I want. So we use that as the reverb, and it's very nice. And we just put a tiny bit in, but it makes it sound like he's in a space. And my little studio here doesn't have a nice space. It's a real dead space. So it's not the ideal thing, but so classical, very natural reverb. And that's why they hunt when they record. They record in certain halls that have great acoustics because they want to capture that space and not have to recreate it with software if possible. I'd also say about jazz classical that the imaging left to right is very important. So you want to recreate what it was like to be in the fourth row in the middle. And so if the strings are on your left, then that's where the strings have to be. If the brass is on your right, then that's where the brass needs to be. So those things are important for jazz classical. Not very much compression, very little unnatural reverb, and the left to right image is important. Okay, moving on. Loops. What is a loop? Well, a loop is any bit of musical information that repeats. I guess, that might be the bottom line. What is a loop? It's in the old days, we used to take a little recording and make it loop. I remember guitar players that had an Echoplex. And so it had a piece of tape on it that just ran in a loop. And so it would record what they're playing, and then they would come back and play it back. And so you heard this over and over again. So that's, the essence of what a loop is any bit that you can repeat over and over again, to make a longer piece of music. For how we're using it, it's generally either a recorded piece that is carefully created and played and trimmed to be right on the beat, so it has exactly a certain number of measures of beat. And if you do stack three or four in a row, you don't hear a break in between. You don't hear any change in tempo. So the tempo's real even all the way through. That's a loop. There are two kinds of them that we work with. There's real loops, real instrument loops, which are actually the little recordings. And they were recorded in a studio somewhere by a real instrument. And there are companies that do this very carefully. And you can buy their loops and you can build some fairly impressive music with it. The other kind of a loop is called a software loop. And that's one that doesn't actually have the recording in it. What it has in it is the information of how to play the instrument. So it actually does. It has information in it on what notes to play, how long to hold those notes, how with what velocity do you play the note, or how loud you play it, you might say, and all sorts of other expression things that be built into it. And so you have that information in this software loop, but what it needs is it needs the instrument. So we have software instruments. So you put a software instrument piano, the one you have available in Studio One is called Presence. And Presence is this all-purpose instrument. And within it, you can choose piano, organ, drums, I don't know. They have a whole bunch of things. They probably have 50 instruments in there. And so your software loop will play the instrument that's in that. So you're using two kinds of software here. You're using the instrument that actually plays the instrument or it gives you the sound of the instrument, and the loop, it plays the software. So two kinds. What does transpose mean? Well, transpose is a term that we borrow directly out of music, and it just means we change the key. So if you have two people playing, bum, 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 and playing whatever that little phrase is, if one of them is starting on the note A and one of them is starting on the note C, they're going to sound different as they move up and down, and they're in different keys. We call them different keys. They might be real similar, but they aren't in the same key. When you play them together, like you put in two loops, one that has the boom, 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 the other has boom, 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 they might or might not sound good together. So transpose means we will take one instrumental bit and we'll change it to be a different key. We'll raise the pitch of all the notes the same amount in order to change it as if somebody's playing it in a different spot on their instrument. So we can say, oh, that one was recorded in A, and I've got another one here that was recorded in B flat, which is right above A. And so I might transpose the A up a little so that it's now in B flat, or I might transpose the one that was in B flat down a little so that now it's being played in A. So we transpose to change the pitch of the whole piece, of the whole snippet or the whole loop. And it gives you all the power in the world to create your own music, because you can change how the song changes and when it changes. A little later on, we will, I'll have you do some, you know, for instance, I'll have you create some blues, because it's, you know, it's blues is always done in sort of a set pattern where how many difference there are in notes between the different parts of a blues song. And so we can recreate that. So we can take one loop, a bass loop, and we can duplicate it, and we can transpose to make the chord changes. And so that's what transpose means. It means take something like a loop or maybe a whole recording and change the pitch of every part of it to be in a new musical key. That's called transpose. And it's built into a software like Studio One, and it's extremely powerful. And hopefully you'll have fun doing it. And on the other hand, you might say, I'm a musician, I hate this. I don't like making this easy, but that's transpose. How exactly do you transpose a loop in Studio One? And I showed you a couple ways on the video. The answer is you can, if you have a loop there, for instance, you can just right click in that loop and a little menu will drop down, and one of them is transpose. And it'll probably say zero for transpose, which means it hasn't been changed. And if you put the number one in instead, that means it's going to move it up one semitone or just one musical bit into the next note. And so you can do it there. If you do minus one, it'll drop it all down. And so we'll spend a little bit more time talking about what, you know, how much transposing should you do to have it sound good. And that's a great topic we'll get to. But it's obvious. The other place where you can change it is in the window called Inspector. So when you're working on things, you can open up the Inspector. So, you know, you have the main window. I forget what it's called just at the moment, but then there's the mix window, the console, there's the edit window. It's the arrange window, isn't it? So that's the main one. But there's another one called Inspector, and Inspector shows up on the side and has all kinds of information about whatever you're clicking on. So you click on a loop and all of a sudden the Inspector gets all this information on, you know, pitch and speed and start and stops and things that you can edit on that particular loop. One of them is transpose. So you can change the pitch in place. So the two answers are right click on the loop, or just open the Inspector and you can change it there. And, you know, by the way, depending on what type of loop it is, you can transpose one way or the other any loop. You can make your own loop. You can go in with your guitar on your system, play a C chord on the guitar, fling, record it, bring it in, trim it, and then duplicate it. And then each instance of it, you can transpose it. So you'll get bling. And then the next one will be bring, and then the next one, you know, whatever. So you can make your own loop. So loops can be little recordings. There's a couple of things that make that easier that we'll talk about later, but loops can be anything. And you can make your own. Let's see. We are back here. Let's think. Okay. Two things you have to remember to do in Studio One to make certain loops you bring in play exactly on the beat. Well, it helps to have the snap on. There's a snap control up at the top, and you turn that on. And that means when you're dragging in a loop, it doesn't just stop anywhere. It actually will stop on a beat. So it'll stop on those count lines. And the beat is just where the beat is. One, two, three, four. That's the beat. And so you have them all start and stop in the same beat. It will, they will play together a lot better. And loops will no matter what speed you have it set at, and down in the bottom is a control for beats per minute, BPM. And so you can put a larger number in there and it'll play everything faster, or a smaller number in there and it'll play everything slower. And a loop will adjust itself. It'll play slower if everything's slower, play faster. So it does that for you. So we want that snap to be on. And there is an option that you can turn on, a checkbox that is called stretch to tempo. And if that isn't on there, then they might not change when you change the speed. So, you know, what you're actually doing is you're telling the, when you change tempo, you expect your loops to stretch a little if they have to, or to shrink a little if they have to. And if you don't have that checked when you start, then they might not check or stretch to tempo. So make sure your snap's on. And if it's not working, find that stretch to tempo checkbox and turn it on. So what's the difference between a loop and a short recorded musical passage? The answer is not much. They both can be used as loops, but a short recorded musical passage has some limitations. One of them is if you transpose it, it will play in the other pitch, but it may not sound like the same instrument anymore. Because if you do play an instrument, you realize that if you play a bass low notes, or you play a bass high notes, the timbre of the sound, the way the overtones on it are a different assembly, low to high. And so it has a different voice. And so if you just change the transpose, all of a sudden your guitar might be sounding like a mandolin or something. And that's not what you want. You want it to sound like a guitar played with a different chord. And so, well, yeah, a short recorded musical passage, I would say the answer is you cannot transpose it as far. You can transpose it a little and it'll sound fine. But if you transpose it very far, it'll start sounding false. However, a loop, most loops, and especially if they're in this, a software loop, you can transpose them all over the place. And the instrument, the software instrument that's playing it, will just adjust it so it'll play that instrument in that range. So you have less editing that you can do with a recorded musical passage. So that's the other thing. You can't transpose a musical passage, a recorded one, as much. And two, you don't have as much editing option on it. So there's a lot of editing options you have it on the software loops. Software loops, quite often you can go in and change one note. You can change what they're playing. Okay. Why is the turn to snap on option important when editing loops? Well, it's because then you'll have them start on the same beat instead of on their own drummer, if you will. The software instrument loop needs the software instrument in order to make a sound. The real instrument loop has the sound recorded in it. Why are loops popular with producers? It saves time. So if you're doing a movie and you've got to do a trailer, for instance, you can get that trailer done without having to call up the union and hire the musicians, get the scores together, get it rehearsed and record it. So it's always going to save time and money. And software, if you have whoever's writing your music, if they give you written in software version, then it can be played by these software instruments. And a lot of these instruments are extremely realistic. And for things like trailers, you're mainly interested in high dynamic things that have a lot of impact and maybe not so much subtlety. So it's okay. It actually sounds pretty close to a good performance. And so let's see, it saves time. There's no contracts because with live musicians, oddly enough, they have to get paid. So there's a contract for each one and you have to keep track of all those contracts. And the final answer is, so the first answer was saves time and money. The second answer is there's no contracts involved. The third answer is you have the license. So the music is licensed to you if you own the software for the software instruments. So you can, once you buy that package, it might cost you a few hundred dollars for a particular orchestra and a particular kind of style. They will have all kinds of loops in there, that all kinds of music from quiet to loud to horn bass to string bass and all those things. And you can create some pretty good music with it. And whatever you create, you own the license for. You don't have to pay the licensing fees. So you don't have to pay the talented people that are working in our industry. But that's why. What is important about the key a loop was recorded in? Well, a key is a set of pitches. And if you have two loops that are recorded in different keys, they won't sound good together. So that means you're either going to have to transpose to figure out, you know, how you make them sound good together, or maybe you can't use them together. So knowing what those loops, what key they're in, helps you a lot. If you just grab loops that are all done in the key of C, you'll have a lot less work when you're putting them together, because they all start out playing together. What's considered a music, library music or production music in the film industry? So these next questions all are kind of share the same answers. It's pre-cleared film music, so the licenses are included. It's all cleared. You own it. There aren't any copyrights. They have sophisticated loops in those. And there are short loops and there are very long loops.